solution my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Oh. Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun.
Well, no thanks, Dax Jacks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. S&P futures are actually down. We'll get the real number here in a second. For some reason, I was looking at so much other stuff. Do we have Professor Carl?
Oh, you do.
How are you, bud?
Well, you know.
Futures are down 18. NASDAQ futures down 187. Oil's up 341, 99.78, pushing to get back to that 100-hour mark, which isn't so hot. So what's up? How are you? Missed you last Friday.
Well, you know, was having a moment, if you will, with my daughter. We were at a pinball museum that is open a couple of weekends a year only. And Friday was a travel day getting up there, and then a bunch of drunken debauchery over the weekend. So, kind of... hard to do the show when you're cruising down the road. I mean, I know I've done it before, but it doesn't work out so great because the
audio quality. Well, we had dudes that covered, but they covered. So, what can I say? So did you? Were you playing Pinball Wizard all the way up there?
Well, no, we play plenty of Pinball Wizard once we got there, in between lemon drop shots.
Well, there you go.
So
what a great song.
Know,
so do you put the blindfold on so you can. Compete.
There you go. So you have to play by feel. That's right.
Yeah.
you know, boy, have we had an interesting little bit here.
Yep.
Finally, you actually have some articles out here which I've pointed out for a while since this whole Iran thing started. Trump has Kim Jong-un. He's made another one. It's on, by the way, it's a headline on Fox News this morning.
He's made another what?
Kim Jong-un. He's got a stalemate. And oh, by the way, the next thing they're going to do is come up with a boom-boom because it's the only way to stop this. And that's exactly what's going to happen. And I pointed this out when it started that... He had, you know, whoever sold him, look, people make mistakes all the time, okay? I mean, that's one of the things about being human is we're rather imperfect creatures. But this was not just common bombast. Trump was sold on the premise that not only was factually false, that Iran was 2 weeks away from having a nuclear weapon and they would use it immediately. And as I've pointed out repeatedly, no, they weren't. And secondly, they had the ability to drop a hot pile on somebody that would be essentially a Fukushima kind of event for the last 5 or 10 years, and they haven't done it. So therefore, the idea that as soon as they get the capacity to do something like this, they'll use it is a lie. It's not an error. It's a lie. And secondly... the premise that all you had to do was bomb some stuff and kill some of their guys, and you would not only generate an immediate revolution, but in addition to that, you'd get all of the nuclear material.
And so it sounds like Netanyahu's appeal.
Well, You know, precisely who sold him on this is an open question, right? I mean, we obviously know who would like to have sold him on this, but who was actually responsible for it is an open question.
According to the one lady with supposedly the mole inside, who, of course, they're all pissed off about.
You know what? First casualty in war is truth. So I take nobody's evidence claimed to exist unless we are listing sources and we have some evidence.
Well, I think the idea that those guys were here, Netanyahu and her people, and had a meeting.
Well, that's fact.
That's fact.
Right. Well, that's fact.
And it would not surprise me from the behavior afterward that Hegseth was one of the biggest supporters and that J.D. Vance was one of the biggest detractors. That's the way they've behaved since then.
Well, okay, fine. However, whoever actually sold Trump on this, if it's a foreign actor, if it's somebody outside the United States, is not primarily a U.S. citizen, but either holds dual citizenship or is not a U.S. citizen at all, that person, and if they are in a position of political power in some other nation, that nation needs to be banhammered from influence in the United States on a permanent basis, period.
I think it's pretty much a fact, not being a Washington insider, that Netanyahu has been badgering like four presidents in a row to do this.
I'm fully aware of this. I want proof.
Yeah.
I want strict proof.
You're never going to get proof. How are you going to get proof?
Not, Chief, listen, strict proof. Well, Congress has not only the right to demand it, they have the obligation to do it, and the reality here is we are talking about something that has now, and oh, by the way, for those of you in the markets, which is like everybody, you know, the whole reason people listen to this show, right?
Yeah.
Supposedly. All right. I want to point out something. You know, the market is whistling past this, and there is a very rude surprise coming. In the 1970s, 73, 74, you had an Arab oil embargo. The knock-on effects of that did not dissipate until 1983, which was after the midterms in Ronald Reagan's first term. He lost a huge amount in the way of representational seats in Congress in 1982 because the economic damage was still going on and people voted their wallets, which they always do. All right. Now, most people who are not old enough, you're old enough, you remember it. I'm old enough, I remember it. The Arab oil embargo was 5 months. Not 5 years, 5 months. And we got 8 years of misery out of it. So those people who think that this is all going to go away and be fine 2 months after this stops, you have rocks in your head.
Then again, you have to, not just like 1973, because the...
By the way, we're in a much worse fiscal position today than we were then.
Without question. The whole world is.
Well, yeah, hello.
Yeah.
So the idea that this is all just going to blow over and go away in a couple of months after the shooting stops, no, it's not.
Well, I think that I'm more of a, I think most of the people on the show and a lot of people who listen sort of agree with me with the monetary policy inclination, contribution to this. But yeah. I think most people think that it's something that just happens alongside, and it really isn't the problem itself in a lot of ways.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's much stronger than that. And I think I'm right when I listen to the confirmation hearings, and not one of the morons, because they're not morons, when I say morons, it's not like they don't know anything, quizzing this new guy. Not one of them even has a question about monetary policy.
Yeah.
It's startling to me that they don't. I mean, the issue in 73 with the, for God's sake, I wasn't in grad school yet, but I could hear the guy on TV. It started in 68 when the Bretton Woods, the U.S. went off the gold standard because we wanted to increase the money supply to essentially print money to pay for the Vietnam War.
Right.
And you couldn't do that before then, before you went off the gold standard, because we had this kind of wacky some sort of ally, but who liked to stick it up our ass, was named Charles de Gaulle. And Charles de Gaulle would actually show up with a ship, you know, not a yacht or anything. He'd show up with a whole bunch of dollar bills, and he'd say, gold's $35 an ounce. Here's $35. Give me an ounce. And we were appalled because we didn't have, you know, we put so much money in the system, and our official gold price was still $35 an ounce.
Right.
And they were fungible.
Right.
And we didn't say, oops, we put so many dollars in the system, it's now 70, because that would have been like, you know, taking your drawers down in public to what
doing. You can't admit the truth, right?
So, yeah. So we never did that, so we just went off the gold standard and put money in the system. So we were already kind of percolating down that road. Then you have a shock like the Arab oil thing, and of course, everybody blamed it on the Arabs. When it really, the oil part was about the Arabs, but if the general inflation was already picking up, and now it just zeroed in on the oil, and they had a data scapegoat.
Oh, you mean kind of like when Trump shoves a 16% electrical power increase up everyone's backside in the United States over the last 2 months, right? You mean like that?
Yep.
By the way, this is just the last of, you know, the most recent of so many, right? You know, we just had this guy that was a crazed lunatic that decided he'd try to, you know, charge the Secret Service barricades at the White House Correspondent Dinner.
Where do we find these guys, Colonel? Even if
running around, Chief, and that screaming that the President of the United States is Adolf Hitler might have something to do with this, especially when you have social media running this crap and CNN and everybody else on a daily basis. My 20-year-old self, if you told me that, here's your H.G. Wells-style time machine, go back to 1937 and go whack that guy, all right, you might have actually convinced me to go do it, all right? Now, the problem is, as I've pointed out...
You had to make sure you killed Heydrich first because he was worse.
Well, this is exactly where I'm going, okay, Chief, is that the problem is on, you know, my 62-year-old self would observe that right now, all right, when the Ukraine thing started up, that plenty of people said, go whack Putin, all right? Not so sure you want to do that because Medvedev is probably worse. He is more likely to nuke Kiev.
We just whacked the Ayatollah, and his kid is worse.
Medvedev probably has a 50% probability of immediately nuking Kiev if we did that, if we killed Putin. Okay. By the way, he has the capacity to do it too because Russia has nukes. And so, is that really such a smart thing to go, you know, nail the guy, right? Maybe not.
Well, obviously, if you run through an armed stop trying to get into something, you're not bright to begin with. But how do you make it through grad school and everything else and not have any? Even if you're a murderer, he's a horrible murderer.
Well, I'm just
thankfully.
There's all kinds of people caterwauling about the security. You know,
they caught the guy 15 feet inside the thing when he. A Russian, where are you going to set the perimeter? 5 miles away?
Well, Chief, he didn't even get through the outer ring.
Yeah, I don't get the...
He charged the outer ring. The security at events like that is layered. The layering held. He never even got to the magnetometer. He was in the outer ring. He charged him. He shot one guy in the vest. He's probably got a couple of cracked ribs. I'm sure he's going to be sore for a couple of weeks, but he's fine. He gets tackled.
Actually, he did not get tackled. He tripped and fell.
Well, they fired several times at him and missed, by the way, which, tells you grit. I mean, people think that kind of thing. People watch too many movies, all right, is essentially the bottom line.
Hitting a moving target with a handgun is pretty damn hard.
Well, anyone running, I mean, the first thing that you learn is if somebody is shooting at you with a handgun, you run away from them on a oblique angle, because it's actually quite difficult to hit anybody in that situation, and only the hits count. The rest just make a lot of noise.
No, the hits hit other people. The misses hit other people.
That's the negative count, right? They count the wrong way. You shoot the wrong people. But point being, he's gonna spend the rest of his life in prison. He very clearly was trying to assassinate the president of the United States. That's a goodbye kind of offense. And you know, Pirro is running around, oh, you know, there's all these conspiracy. I tell bullshit.
The guy's a
nutbag. He got on a train so that they. By the way, you can check firearms on an aircraft. You just can't bring them in the cabin. But you know, there was a lot of premeditation obviously involved in this, so any kind of diminished capacity.
How would you feel like if you were like sitting next to him on the train for like 1,000 miles talking to him?
In the general sense, I don't have, you know, this is a Second Amendment cognizant state that I live in. Probably a quarter of the people in the grocery store when I go to the grocery store are armed, so who cares? Maybe I'm armed. You know, you never know. Do I expect to need it? No. That the entire reason that I bring it is just in case, right? Because you know, hey, there are nutbags in the world. A good, big surprise, right? So I'm just. I look at all this stuff that's going on right now, though, and from an economic perspective, the people that are doing the screaming the most. In my opinion, are some of the biggest problems at the present day, and we've got trouble here. All right, we've got a lot of trouble coming.
We have trouble everywhere. I mean, you don't even have to look at here. I mean, we have. Look what's going on with Israel and Gaza. I'm talking about the politics. I'm talking about anything, but
no,
we're talking about people living in an area, and I've read stuff, and who the hell knows that one out of six people in Gaza have a family member that's been killed or badly wounded by the Israelis.
Yeah.
Without lobbing into the politics,
right?
It's not exactly the way you make friends and influence people.
Well, not only that, but we've talked about the Iranians and the possibility of them, targeting a water plant. Okay. Well, the fine Israeli settlers over there are making a practice of sabotaging the water infrastructure going into Gaza. This has been reported on extensively.
Well, and the what's stuff going on in Lebanon, not of course by any newspaper, from what I'm gathering from different places, is that they're kicking out the Christians as much as they are the Muslims.
Well, of course they are, and the Israelis, are going in there and desecrating Christian statues and things. I mean, look, war is not a pleasant set of circumstances, all right? And anybody who thinks they are has rocks in their head. So I have very little in the way of love or hatred either way on this kind of stuff. If you don't like wars, it would probably be a good idea if you didn't start one for openers.
Starting is easy.
It's the stopping them that's the problem. But what I think everybody is ignoring right now from an economic point of view is that, and by the way, Warsh, I don't know if you listened to his confirmation hearing, but I did. For those people that think that the minute he gets in office, you're going to see rates come down, you got rocks in your head. Okay, I mean, Elizabeth Warren spent her time going after him because he wouldn't tell her exactly where his money is. Frankly, I think that's a perfectly legitimate question to be asked. And I think one of the problems that we have is the number of people who are doing things like that in Congress. I mean, you take a look at Ilhan Omar, who very clearly has attempted to evade accountability in this regard, in that when people started asking questions, her husband turned around and dissolved the so-called winery LLC that they held. All right, the dissolution filing is a public record. I've looked at it. And oh, by the way, anyone that thinks that there isn't anything hinky going on there, when all of a sudden this winery goes from being nothing to, you know, tens of millions of dollars and then all of a sudden disappears again, is, oh, it's not really worth anything. Yeah, I got, there's a bridge for sale.
Wine sales are down a little bit.
Yeah, well, okay.
Yeah.
Anyone that buys that load of BS, all right, but that's, I mean, look, this kind of thing is absolutely common. Now, here's another outrage that just hit the wires a couple days ago. Remember, during the crazy, all right, the ads that were run all over television, if you have COVID, Paxlovid. Remember this?
Yep.
Okay, FDA-approved drug, New England Journal of Medicine. I have issues with you know, their peer review processes and things like this, and I have ragged on some of the studies that they've published in the past because I think they're a load of crap. But they have a scoping review on two studies that were run on Paxlovid, and the evidence is that both of them were worthless in preventing hospitalization and death. They did nothing. Confidence interval crossed zero. That's worthless. And, oh, by the way, there was a substantial risk of serious adverse events. So not only was the drug worthless, it caused harm. All right, so it wasn't just, you're not just eating sugar pills. And, oh, by the way, the course of treatment's over $1,500. Now, this was an approved therapy. Approved. Where was the data, and where'd it come from, and who generated it, and who reviewed it, that got this through the FDA? And where are the criminal fraud charges? Why isn't Pfizer being destroyed and forced to disgorge every single penny they made from that drug, and, oh, by the way, and compensate everyone who got a serious adverse event, and get hit with punitive damages for fraud? Where is it?
We can't do that. We're trying to find the guys looking for a job at Home Depot in the parking lot.
Well, you know what? There are so many of these kinds of things that occurred during those years. All right.
They're still occurring.
They're still doing it. All right. And we're still, after all this, I don't know where this
if anybody, you know, the
this crazy inflection in cancers that showed up right at the same time something else started and has not gone away.
No, it has not gone away. I have a, you know, the concern I have with this is one of the dudes who's on, one of our contributors, actually, sent me a YouTube and wasn't all that political, although you could tell, you know, where the guy was coming from. But he went and described where exactly all the issues are with the Strait of Hormuz being closed.
Yeah.
And he brought up a lot of stuff regarding, you know, whenever you, it's funny, if you try and open your eyes, which I do, because, A, I want to do the best I can for my clients and the people who listen, but I also listen to the people who are on here. People like, everybody brings a nugget every day. Some people way more than one. You could be in that group. I'm not going to say that to you while you're on, though. I don't want you to get a big head.
Okay.
But everybody brings a nugget. And this guy, it was a half-hour thing. I don't usually listen to a half-hour YouTube. But I did. And he went through, like, all the products, other than oil, that come through the strait. He's talking about sulfur. He's talking about stuff you make fertilizer with. He's talking about things like that.
Oh, yeah. Sulfuric acid is like a big thing.
But then he went on to say, because you can't do that, you're causing oil to go the other way to the pipeline, which has now caused a backup even in the Panama Canal, because it has worldwide implications. And
this is going to be over in 3 months.
Well, the people, I didn't realize that they're doing a pecking order on the like the Panama Canal. If you pay more, you get to the front of the line.
Well, of course.
Well, okay, but I didn't know that. Maybe you, that's
why,
what I'm saying.
I would
suspect that, but I never heard it before. Let's put it that way.
Well, I heard it. Duh.
But I can suspect a lot of things, but unless I actually hear it happening, you know, it's just a suspicion. And they're talking about how the oil tankers, the price of oil is so high, they're pumping to the front. You know, some of the big ones can't get through, I know, but they're saying, like, the, you know, if you're hauling fertilizer, it's not that high priced of a good, even at the prices that are up where they are. So you're basically at the shit end of the line. So you just talked about the entire world being piggy move up, and how this is affecting farmers to such an extent. And if you go back to the issues in the 20s before the 29 crash, it was essentially a worldwide agrarian depression for 10 years leading up to where all the other people, and I'm tying what you're talking about here together with what Hal's been going down the line with, have been talking about the availability of credit for the select few,
yeah,
that essentially own the media as well. Even they, you know, in 19, there's two kinds of ways to own the media. One is you actually own the media, and the other is it's the story everybody wants to hear. I mean, nobody wants to hear about the price of fertilizer in Peoria.
Right.
I mean, even though it may affect you more than, you know, somebody being tackled or whatever he was, to a certain extent, that doesn't affect anybody, really. I mean, because the guy was unsuccessful.
Okay, Chief. Here's the thing. All right. This is where people are absolutely going to get it in the butt. All right. And this is the electrical stuff. And the cost structure, the cost push structure that's been forced into the system by, not just by the war, because Trump could have, under the DPA, when this started, he could have slammed the door on energy exports out of the United States, which would have protected, to a large degree, not completely, but to a large degree, would have protected
that
the American economy.
That doesn't help his buddies.
Well, I understand that, but you know what he did instead? Was he protected the Europeans, who, by their own hand, bought into the green energy scam, that carbon was unnecessary, and then when it got shoved up their butt as a result of the Strait of Hormuz being shut down, instead of saying, you made this bed, you sleep in it.
No, wait a minute. You're going too,
you
way too far.
You eat your own effing cooking.
You're going way too far. The most energy-friendly president we had ever, no, he wasn't my favorite, was Bushy too.
When Bushy left office,
there was less drilling than when he went in. Because they hadn't invented fracking yet.
Okay, Chief, I understand that. But the point is this. In shoulder season, which is where we are right now, remember the pecking order, and 90% of the people that are listening to this show and are running around in the street do not understand how this works. Electrical generation has two basic components. Three now, because you got all this green crap in there. The first one is base load plants. The reason that they cannot change their output rapidly, it takes hours or days for them to do so. And the reason is the thermal mass of the plant is so huge that if you stop making heat, the residual heat doesn't instantly go away. So a large coal-fired power plant is like this. A nuclear plant is like this. Nuclear plants have another issue related to xenon poisoning, which gets a little esoteric. I could explain it, but it'd take a while. The bottom line is that a coal-fired power plant or a nuclear plant that is producing a gigawatt, if the demand drops by 200 megawatts, they cannot load follow that 200 megawatts down on an immediate basis. They can't. It's not possible, okay? And if they try to do it, they'll trip, at which point they produce zero.
That's why you pump water upstream at night, and it comes down to daytime, and you use it.
Well, guess what? TVA has been doing that now for a while. All right,
because so does Illinois underground.
Well, we've got you know, if you've got places that are suitable for this, okay. All right. So that's number one. So the second problem is renewable resources, solar and wind in particular, are unreliable. Therefore, you have to have something to back them up, because otherwise, when the sun is not out and the wind is not blowing, if you do not, you get blackouts. So you have to have something else to cover that and increase it. And then the third element is peaking plants. Now, those are able to load follow very rapidly. And, you know, we were talking, Hal's been sending around some stuff.
How big are those? I mean, you know, I know they have a bunch around Chicago, but I don't know if I've ever seen one. How big are they?
Peaking plants?
Yeah.
The size of a jet engine.
But I mean, but you got to have wires leading into the place.
Well, I understand that, but they're really easy to spot once you know what you're looking for.
Okay. Well, I mean, the coal plant they took out on the border in Indiana.
Yeah.
There's boatloads of wires heading that way to where the plant used to be, and the wires are still there. They're probably still kind of a junction point for the grid, but
yeah.
I mean, I've never seen that to like something as big as, you know, you can put on a block or anything.
No, they're not very big, Chief.
But I've never seen. The Warriors must be underground, though.
There's a whole on I-75 coming in near Ohio. In Ohio, there's a whole stack of them, and in you know, right near the highway, you can see them. Okay, they're gas turbines.
Well, they must be somewhere. I just have never. I've never seen one.
Oh no, they're all over the place. But they're basically they're a stationary jet engine with a generator on that on the butt end of it. Okay, and most of them run combined cycle, which is a way to get more efficiency. You get about 65-ish% conversion efficiency from the heat because of the combined cycle. Your standard Rankine cycle can only get to about 35. These get about 65, so they're much more efficient.
All right, so explain to me this. How do...
All right, so here's the point, though, Chief. This fuel cost adjustment out of TVA that I just saw a few days ago is a direct result of us shipping LNG over to Europe. All right, telling every European guy who was getting LNG from the Persian Gulf to send the effing tankers over to the United States.
You heard the president say that.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Trump, out there, come on over. We got plenty of it. Okay. True statement. However, demand without additional supply shows up in price. First law of economics, right? 2 cent per kilowatt hour fuel cost adjustment that is going to show up on people's bills that are served by TVA and Cub, well, Cub and others, but served by TVA, which is basically a huge swath of this area. Right, not just Tennessee, but neighboring states. 2 cent a kilowatt hour adjustment for us here. That's going to be about a 16% increase in electric bills. Now we are in a shoulder season right now. We are not using heat. We're not using air conditioning.
We're supposed to be building up the buildup at this point.
But we're not because we're shipping the stuff overseas.
See, your problem, Carlos. You're not a very good MAGA kind of guy because.
Chief, 2 months from now, it's not going to be 16%. It's going to be 50% because those peaking plants are the ones that provide power.
I understand.
When your air conditioner
is
on.
But problem is you're not a MAGA guy good enough because you actually listen to what somebody says. If you listen to the president say this, and we've gone over this on the show 100 times, that basically I don't understand all of it, to be honest with you, but our energy production versus use in this country on a gross scale is roughly even. It's like 21 million barrel equivalent versus 21 million barrel. There supposedly is a slight positive, although that's dropping because we're starting to see a small but significant decline in the fracking areas.
Yeah.
But it's not really, the numbers don't match. If you look at the field production, you're going to see a number of 13.5.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, if Joel's on, we'll let him fly because Kenny's not going to be here. But there's a 13.5. But you actually look at the numbers, it'll say we produce 20 million equivalent barrels, the other being propane, other kinds of stuff. Now, without going into the mix part of it, when you have somebody get on national TV that looks orange and says, oh, by the way, we don't really care, he essentially said in the one speech, what goes on over there. This is for other people. It's their job to open the strait, because we don't really care. We're fine here. Okay, now we're even, which means we're quote fine. But what you just said is true. He goes, by the way, we'll sell you all you want. Well, right. That is about the most ignorant statement I've ever heard.
That's the dumbest thing that I've ever heard.
But yet the MAGA people somehow feel it's their responsibility to dig in somewhere and say, he's really brilliant, because if he really meant this. No, he didn't. I know what he said. I listened to him 3 times. I didn't.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't care what somebody behind the scenes. Oh, yeah, if you really look. Not to mention the fact that out of all this mess, as much as we bitch about gasoline sales, we would be much better off paying an extra dollar a gallon for gas if diesel came down a buck and a half. Because diesel is in everything we do, we eat, whatever.
Right. Just,
and yet that is to the moon, because that's what we're selling to people, which is insane.
You know what? We started that around the 2007-08 time frame, which formerly diesel was not allowed to be exported out of the United States.
For most of my lifetime, diesel has been less than gas.
Well, during the summer, it always was, because it's also home heating oil and nobody uses their furnace in the middle of July.
Right.
Okay. But
how much down, if at all, is the usual Northwest area that's still used home heating oil Is that slipping every year? Yeah, northeast.
Northeast. And the reason is that piped gas is cheaper.
Is propane cheaper or not? I don't know.
No, generally it is not.
It's not the normal heater? Oh, wow.
No. Generally, propane is considerably... propane is pretty much your worst option. It's the one you use if you don't have any other good ones.
Well, I mean, how could you not have home heating oil as an option? I mean, that's everywhere.
Well, which is cheaper depends on the... depends on many things, and it fluctuates, okay. whether propane or home heating oil is. But the other thing is that propane, propane's fairly easy to transport by tank. Home heating oil is a little less.
I mean, in 73, when they talked about the Northeast uses, there has to be 40% less homes heated up there by heating oil than there was in the 70s,
If you've, if you've got gas, I mean, when I was growing up, our home was heated by oil, okay? And as soon as the gas pipe showed up...
Let me turn the question around. When's the last time you think a new home was built that used home heating oil? They still build them up there?
I sort of doubt it. I mean, it's... But the thing is that the minute... Well, and the reason was, as soon as gas showed up at the end of the street, on the street, right, in front of the house, we converted. And the payback time was like 2 years. And that included trenching the yard.
Did you pull the whole thing out, or did you get and put a whole new furnace in?
Oh, yeah, you have to.
No, you don't.
You could probably do a burner conversion, but it's
not... No, I'm talking about... I misspoke. If you had coal, which my grandparents did...
All right, well, that's...
You put the oil grates in there. You can put... Actually, in some of the schools I was in...
You can take them out and put the gas...
Yeah, when they converted to gas, they just put gas grates in the old coal boiler.
Yeah, well, that's...
I mean, was all that efficient, but...
Well, we were forced there, but it was an oil furnace.
Okay,
an oil burner, and it was old. I mean, it was from the time of the house was built. We converted the unit. Now we didn't have... where I grew up, we didn't ever...
Well, coal furnace never really wears out.
But that was the thing. The heat exchanger was old and things like that. So, I mean, the unit got ripped out and replaced. But the payback, including doing that and everything else, was 2 years. Okay, it was that much less expensive. So, I mean, if you have access to piped gas is a better deal. The problem, and I've explained this to people, that if, in a large commercial user, a school or whatever, that I've explained to people it in terms of budgeting, you got to be very careful. Natural gas in general is a much less expensive fuel. The problem is that every now and then it has extreme price spikes. And if you look at a 20-year or 30-year chart of natural gas futures, you'll see them, all right? So if you're a large user, if you're a home user...
That's due to the fact that nobody has any in storage. Your house.
Well, I get that, Chief. But the thing is, if you're a home user, your utility supplier probably hedges this off sufficiently that the odds of you getting burned by it are pretty low. Okay, because these spikes don't last for very long. But if you're an industrial user, you're exposed on this. And so, if you are buying in volume, for a school or something like this, you either need to be managing it, or you need to have the budgetary flexibility to deal with that when it happens.
Or you could be Enron that absolutely denutted California because they had all these restrictions, and they just took California gas, moved it outside of California, and moved it back, because then you could raise the price.
Yeah, I'm just saying, the average homeowner does not have to deal with too much of that, but the large user does, and so... it's just something to keep in mind, in that it's not all roses and wonder. If you get burned by one of those things the year after you put it in, you're going to have a really nasty operating cash flow.
Plus, we've wasted so much natural gas in this country because of before you could liquefy it on a ship.
Well, you have to flare it off if you know.
Did we flare off on the north shore, for God's sake?
Oh, it comes out. It's part of the mix that comes up the well, and if you don't have anything useful to do with it, there's a problem, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so the but this the economic impact of this stuff.
By the way, speaking of politics, and because our president this is before him, but for some reason hates Canada, which I don't quite get. But there was the North Shore, Alaska. I'm talking about North Slope. Sorry, not North Shore.
Yeah, North Slope.
North Slope has been flaring off gas for most of my lifetime. And because at the time, you really should have built two pipelines, one for oil and one for natural gas right next to it. But that didn't do you any good in those days because you couldn't liquefy it. So if you got all the natural gas down to the oil tournament, what were you going to do with it? You have to flare it off there, right?
Yes and no. I mean, the
what are you going to do with all the natural gas in Point, what's the name of it, Valdez, Alaska?
Well, you run a parallel pipeline down to the into the U.S. and
okay, well, that's... They,
you know. Which they didn't have, right.
Which, and then all of a sudden, about 15, 20 years ago, maybe, they decide, okay, we probably should get this pipeline.
Yeah.
So the Alaskan, the cheapest way to do it would be to go across Canada and tap into an existing Canadian pipeline,
which
actually comes all the way down to the Midwest here.
Yeah.
Well, the Alaska governor said, we're not doing that.
We're not doing, yeah.
Because, no, we want our own, we want the whole thing here. We want to run it down to. They thought about it, the thing was never built.
Yeah, I know.
So how much in that 15-year period? How much gas have we wasted?
Oh, not a small amount.
Not a small amount. No.
I mean, you know, but the thing is, you know, what people need to understand, Chief, is that the economic disruption. Okay, this is we are now at the point today, right now, we're about 40%. In terms of time of the oil shocks of the 1970s, okay? In terms of the interruption time, period of time.
Except this time, there's all these other ancillary products.
I get this, okay? Point being, the last time around that set off an aw crap in the American economy, it was 8 years.
Are you talking about the market, or are you talking about the economy?
Both.
Okay. I'm just asking. Right. You are right, by the way.
Both.
And, well, most and people because, find there's been a split, though. Now, if the market's up, everything's okay.
No, you know what? The market's up because the Pavlovian response since 2008 and what the Federal Reserve has done and the government has done, which Hal's pointed out, okay.
By the way, article I read the other day says it goes back to 87.
Well, okay, but look, I brought the graph up, posted it a couple of weeks ago. Fed funds has been below the rate of deficit spending on an unbroken basis since the 2008 crash. All right, now that is by definition paying people to add leverage to the system, and the people who are getting paid are not you and I.
Well, you know, right? it's. By the
it's
way,
the
we
have, Goldmans, it's all these guys.
We have now, a few time. You haven't been around for a bit. Would you mind if we comment on... I've been trying to expand on the stuff Hal's been working on.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, every guest I get, I seem to... Larissa, for sure, on Wednesday, was expounding on this a lot, and Russell was helping her out a lot, in terms of who's actually like getting this dough. And yesterday... It was an interesting day. Now, NVIDIA's down $6 today, but the last 2 days, it was up $17.
Yeah.
And there's 25 million shares outstanding, so that's...
Yeah, that's...
What's that,
yeah, that's
$425 million?
Yeah, that's a hell of a lot of money.
$1 billion, that's a lot of money. And but the thing of it is, what, you know, I'm sitting right here in the middle. Sometimes you don't... And I've talked to people on the show about how hard is it them for you to get a loan? And I've talked to people in banks, and you read this stuff, and Hal brings this out, and he didn't even bring out the specifics. He was just talking about how, because of the banking regulations, it's not just the amount of money that the Fed has put in, because in grad school, even with the monetary people that I was studying under, guys like Friedman and Stigler and those people, they never delineated being professors. They never delineated between the unevenness of how the credit came into the system.
Right.
And although Milton Friedman was very clear in saying that inflation is the cruelest tax of all. And, right. And again, from the MAGA people, not, you know, whatever. I didn't like the Democratic person either, so I'm, but for the real MAGA, you know, who wants to put their hands over their ears about other stuff, you have a president who didn't want to raise taxes, or said he didn't. He lowered them for some people, and then he throws in a stack of tariffs, which is about as regressive as you get. And but the, probably the single most regressive tax is inflation.
Yeah.
So if you do those two things, you've raised taxes a boatload. Anyway, but and I just it just dawned on me the other day when I was talking to one of the listeners, and they were saying about how not a listener, one of the contributors, how somebody was having trouble getting a loan somewhere, and I'm thinking all of a sudden it just popped in my feeble brain. I said, wait a minute. I'm lead owner of a securities firm. Why am I so dense on this? Somebody can send me, I'm looking at Nike's trading 45, Nike's down to $45, wow. Somebody could buy 1,000 shares of Nike, and all the guys do is fill out an application.
Right.
And send me, send PTI, or RBC, you know, our clearing firm, through us, $22,500.
Right.
They will unhesitatingly lend this person
the rest of the money.
The rest of the money, 50%. Right. And yet, right, you and I, and let's say, well, two other regular people that have a good credit rating and everything from this show can plunk down $150,000 on a decrepit old house, go to the bank and say, "Fixed up, this thing's worth $500,000. How about lending us $150,000?" They're going to kick our can right out the door.
They get you told, yeah, you get told to go pound sand.
Yeah, right. And so I didn't even though I'm right in the middle of it, it never actually dawned on me how uneven this is. That's why the market can race up like there's no tomorrow, and nobody else can build a house.
Well, Chief, it's by design.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's what Al brought up. Why did I never think of that before, Al?
Well, but here's because you're in the business.
Yeah. yeah.
Here's the problem with this. As I have, you know, I point this out when I wrote leverage, any use of leverage, any use of credit, is a two-edged sword. It cuts equally in both directions. It is just as bad for you on the way down as it was good for you on the way up.
It's worse.
All right. Well, it and the math of a 50% loss is way worse than most people think, because now you need a double. All right, you don't need a 50% gain to get back to where you were. You need a double to get back to where you were. But you only lost half. Okay, that once it rolls around for a few seconds in someone's head, they tend to understand that one. But most people don't think of it that way. And it's like, oh, no, this is not going to happen again. Yes, it is. I don't know what's going to set it off. But look, we have cyclically adjusted PEs are higher. I don't think there's anywhere that they've actually been higher. I think this is a record high. And just general PEs are ridiculously high. Now, there's a problem with this, which is that the...
Do me a favor, will you, as you go forward, I'm not asking to try and change your mind. Whenever you look at a PE, look at the revenue per share in addition to the PE.
I know.
Yeah.
All right? But look, let me point out where the problem is with this. What's underpinned a lot of this, and this has been true all the way back to when I used to be in the internet business. The reason the NASDAQ has always had a higher multiple, always, is that an awful lot of those businesses are pure services, and therefore the cost of goods sold, if you will, the COGS line on the balance sheet and on the revenue and earnings statements, is lower as a percentage. All right? Because I don't need to buy steel to make cars, right, when I'm selling internet service. Now I have to buy a bunch of other stuff, but I don't have to buy that.
You also don't pay a dividend.
Well, I get that.
Yeah.
Okay,
well, that's a
but
big
here's
part
the problem. But here's the other problem with this, and this is something Buffett's talked about this, and nobody wants to talk about it. You know, even though the guy's got a hell of a history of understanding how this stuff works, because he's been around forever. All right, he's older than dirt, and he's still here. Yeah, you know, he's in the Art Cashin group, right?
He's not even older than dirt. He's here and he's very vibrant.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah.
But here is the point that he has made, and I've pointed this out to people as well, which is that any time that you have a situation where somebody's got a 30% pre-tax operating margin, Okay, we ran 36 for a couple of years.
Right? Okay.
That made me extremely nervous. And the reason is that anytime you have an operating margin up there like that, you attract competitors.
Well, you should attract competitors.
Well, yes.
It's up to you to block them.
Well, and by the way, we have become a country where you explicitly solicit the government to engage
right.
in illegal conduct to prevent someone from shooting at you, which is what otherwise is going to happen, all right? And it is as certainly as night follows day, it's going to happen. So you do everything in your power, damned the law, to prevent that.
Read drug companies, read gas companies,
Absolutely, all right? But the problem with this is the compounding effect that you get when those operating margins come down on a PE multiple collapse gets really ugly. And so when you see valuations where they are today and people say, oh, you know, you're crazy, you know, 50% declines in indices and things like this, and we're like, look, that's actually an optimistic scenario, because if you get a margin collapse on top of this, you could see 70 or 80%.
We did before, 2000.
We have several times in the past. And people think that can't happen. Yes, it can.
Not if the Fed just keeps pouring money in.
Wrong. Because if your power bill doubles, half the people in this town aren't going to be able to pay it.
You know, where you're... First of all, I agree with you, but I love to disagree with you just for laughs. You know where you're wrong? Look at the final charts of the Weimar Republic. The market never collapsed
in their currency. Yeah, well, guess what? Yeah, the Weimar Republic also ended in a war. And how many people died?
Oh, I didn't say it. I didn't say it. That was...
Listen, if you're dead, you don't care what the stock market is.
I'm going to say, if we do this for another... Well, it hasn't been just Trump. I mean, it's been people before him. If we do this another 3, 4, 5 years, I'm going to say... I have a lot of client calls today, and people are going to ask me, what do we want to do here? And I'm going to say, my heart tells me that 85% of what's happening, the people are gagging on this stuff. We're going to see food prices to the moon. We're going to see, I don't know what the money supply numbers come out today for March. We'll see what they say. But yet on the other token, if they keep putting money in, you can't fade the market today, because every time we're down, somebody's buying.
So I understand that.
I mean, I don't know the timing here. The principle I'm with you on, but I'm not so sure that we couldn't see a very... I think we actually might have had a minor one for the last 20 years, that we couldn't see a very serious recession affecting 85% of the people and the market actually be unchanged or up. It makes no sense to do that, but these guys are going to try.
Well, they're going to try and they're going to fail.
I think
you're talking about the externalities and the energy side. People that are whistling past on this one, I think this is an extremely serious.
Okay, we had the COVID situation.
Right? COVID situation was a self-imposed.
Okay,
lockdown.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm trying to make your case and just say, I'm going to say. The thing driving these people, whoever they are, is in the COVID situation, by any stretch, by any third grade economist, because they shut it down, we were in a technical depression, weren't we, for God's sake? I mean, the market was down for what?
It was self-imposed.
Okay, but whatever. But yes. I'm saying, but in 4 weeks, it was never clear that we were going to come out of it. But they thought everybody was going to be dead, for God's sake.
No, for sure. Oh.
I'm not talking about you and me. I'm talking about, it was not clear that, but my point is, 4 months into it, the market was up from where we started.
I understand that.
But now here, how many more days can you listen to these people on TV talking about how market's up because there's a chance of a ceasefire? Trump says that, guys are going to Pakistan. Market's up. Is anybody put their finger on the blackboard, showing my age, and say, with all this crap, the fact that there is enthusiasm and it might be over, I get all that part. We're higher than we were when we started. I mean, where is what you're trying to say and what I agree with you, Where does that message land? Nowhere.
Chief Pavlov,
there's no connection between one and the other.
No.
There should be.
No, that's not true. Where it lands is when the power company here sends out bills in July for your house, okay? And instead of being $200 to cool your house, it's $5 and you ain't got it.
Okay. Would
And then, by the way, now that we all have electronic meters, they don't even have to send the guy around to yank it. All they do is push a button and your power goes off.
Right, here's where, again, it's very difficult for me to argue with somebody that I'm agreeing with. I understand, with the brokerage firm, if everybody else and all my potential clients are starting to get somebody's hands wrapped around their neck, the chances of them sending me the $22,000 for the 1,000 shares in Nike become less and less and less. Correct? We both agreed on that.
Yeah, that's exactly the problem.
However, in the last 3 days, just in NVIDIA, by the same thing happened to Google, it's way up, and there's the $400 billion we're talking about in market cap, that is $200 billion in somebody calling the PTIs and Merrill Lynch's of the world saying, buy me more. And the answer is yes. Because
that's
buying power. So even though the chance of the client, the guy who says, I'd really like to open up an account, but by the way, I'm broke. I mean, I know I'm going to run into that, right? I mean, duh. We both know that. But because I can't afford the $22,000. But if he can, the other $22,000 is there for the grabbing. So as long as you can sort of keep it going up, it has a life of its own.
There's going to be
a wall. We've been predicting.
You understand how this works on the other side?
Yes.
Which is that the fact that I've got my screen up here where we're talking, okay, and I'm watching the futures bleed a little bit.
Right? They're getting whacked.
S&P's
are down 48. Nasdaq's.
I'm sorry, I don't consider down 48 to be whacked.
Okay, well the Nasdaq is down 1.3%, which it used to be a huge day. Now it's
I'm just saying I don't consider 300 points on Nasdaq to be much either anymore. Okay,
that's part of the problem, right?
Well, yeah, it is. But here's the thing that my point on this, and I've explained this to people. They look at me like I've got six heads. Okay, and I just go back to what happened back in 2006, 2007, and then again in 1998, 1999 when I sold my internet company.
Long-term capital, 87, the list goes on.
I have people telling me, well, I got $2 million in my brokerage account, my Fidelity account or Schwab or whatever, or maybe, if they're lucky, it's in PTI, right? And by the way, I own two houses, or three houses. And I said, yeah, and I had a friend of mine who I knew somewhat, not real well, but someone I knew fairly well, when I lived in Florida. In 2006, he had a couple million in his brokerage account and three houses. And in 2009, he had zero and zero houses.
Oh, I get it.
Okay. And so, and the thing is, people look at you like, what? I said, yeah, that really happened. And I won't go into what he claimed to happen to him, and then, none of it was his fault. Oh, like, blankety blank, it wasn't, right?
Yeah. Well, if we ever come to that, you and I know that it never lasts forever. But I do know that the amount of money in the system, I mean, how long, if we had the personnel, and the time, if I was 30 years old and had a, had a bunch of dough and had a philanthropic heart, which I think I still do. But if I was gonna go to maybe developing communities, maybe minority communities, poor communities, don't have to be minority, just towns where factories have left. If I was gonna go into the local bank and have somebody in there selling just something simple, something like mutual funds, where you give people an opportunity to. $100 a month, whatever. Get yourself, if you're age 25, get yourself a nest egg in the market. I still believe in investment in this country. Obviously, I have a firm. I don't have to be doing, call and put positions that only I know how to do, and I'll say that to anybody. There used to be a lot of people, but a lot of them are out of the business. I mean, only I know how to do it. We're not talking about that. We're talking about somebody who's their first investment, other than maybe the savings account, something different. I would have to work how many months, how many years to get enough, get anywhere near the amount in thousands of accounts total than by getting one person who's been riding this bus for a while.
Oh, no, I get it.
The difference between the 85% and the rest of the people is so dramatic, it's scary.
Chief, I understand it. And I'm not arguing against that. All right, all I'm saying is that the numbers on the screen, until and unless you sell it and reduce it to cash, can disappear just as fast as they showed up, and usually does faster. Right.
Would you ever have guessed, even with all the history, going back to 87 and long term, and all the antics of our Fed, which brings us kind of full circle to Elizabeth Warren and these people? I happen to think, from my resume, look at this guy, Warsh, he maybe even is more conservative than we think. But then in the back of my mind is, I don't know what goes on. Just like a Supreme Court justice, before they get nominated, they have the 3-hour interview in the Oval Office.
Right.
What? And then they head to the Senate, and all they do is promise how, man, I got no such thing as a...
Oh, and 5 minutes after they take the oath.
Yeah.
Right.
The question is, this guy's saying all the right things to Elizabeth Warren and fighting back.
Well, actually, he's not, but...
Well, whatever, but...
She's pissed, but yeah.
Okay, but who knows? The fact is, the president thinks that the current guy, who's done everything he asked him to do, isn't doing enough, and the new guy will. So whatever bullshit the guy tells Congress for 3 days to get his ass in there, there's something more to it. I mean, there obviously is, because they're not going to put me in there, because they know what I'm going to do, right?
Right.
I mean, so he's going in there for a reason, and clearly there's a spread between what he's telling Congress and at least what Trump thinks he's going to do.
No, you think?
Yeah, you think? I mean, this is so obvious to anybody. It's like, what do you? How many Supreme Court justices have we gone through? And then here it is 5 years later, with rare exceptions, you can predict every one of their votes.
Well, you know, I think it's going to be a very interesting situation, because now, you know, I'm sure you heard a couple days ago DOJ dropped the stuff into Powell.
Why do you say that?
Huh?
Why do you say that?
They did.
No, they didn't.
I understood that they dropped.
They moved it to Carolyn Leavitt, his blind mouthpiece.
Right.
Oh no, we didn't drop it. We just moved it. It could come right back.
Oh, all right. Well, my understanding was that it was dropped.
No, it went to Inspector General's office.
Oh, all right. Well, all right.
And if they find something, it comes right back.
Oh, okay. Well, then the situation has not been resolved. I thought that was.
Tillis claims that he talked to the Inspector General and everything's cool. But the fact is, it's not dropped.
Okay.
It's dropped by the Department of Justice. It is not gone away.
It's not gone.
Yes.
All right. Well, if it hasn't been dismissed with prejudice, then it's not gone.
Right.
My understanding was that it was gone. But
no.
Okay. I'm wrong. That's fine.
Well, you might be wrong. I mean,
we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll see. I just, you know, it's just one of these things that I just...
Powell's not been pardoned like half the other crooks that he's pardoned.
Well, I don't see that. You know, that should have never happened in the first place anywhere, but yeah, whatever. So...
Is Powell going to quit?
Well, it's not quit. His term
resign.
Ends. Right. Well, his term ends as chair.
Yes.
But he still has time on as a governor.
2 years.
Right. So now, I mean, by not by policy, not by requirement, but you know, by common practice, the chair, when his term ends, resigns from the board. Okay, but he's not required to do that. He can sit for the next 2 years on the board. Is he going to? I don't have any idea. We'll see. But here's, you know, Chief.
For those that don't know, I forget how long the term is, but nobody usually, nobody ever has, but usually it's kind of weird, because the terms are like, what, 12, 14 years or something?
Yeah, but Houston.
But I'm saying, so now if Powell does resign, the opening is the end of Powell's term. So the new guy will be in only for the 2 years.
Right, and then he has to be.
So that's why when people kind of resign early, they may have been in there for 20 years and really have not served out their first term that they were nominated for.
Yeah.
Because they maybe did the last 8 years of the guy before him's term, and now they're 8 years into there, and you say, the guy's been here forever. He hasn't really even served out his, 12 or 14 years. It's kind of weird. So the new guy, if he's in, his board spot will not be as long as his spot as the chief.
Yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah.
It is what it is. But Powell
has every right to sit there for 2 years.
Yeah, if he wants to, sure.
In which case, Trump is going to have to either get somebody else to resign, or he's going to have to pick somebody who's already on there.
Yeah, we'll see how this all works out. The thing, though, that I think is most interesting about this entire situation is that people think that the Fed today works more or less the way that the Fed worked when Burns was sitting at the head of the chair, right? There were no formal minutes. There really wasn't a vote, all right? Not the way you think of votes.
Well, you can clean up the minutes like there's.
Well, but I'm saying there was no democratic process. The chair was essentially a dictator, all right?
Well, there always was. They could have voted against it. They just never did.
Well, but the chair was effectively a dictator because there was no pushback available because it wasn't publicly, it wasn't a public thing. There were no press conferences or none of this kind of stuff. And the press conference thing is pretty recent, too. But today, Warsh, gets on there. He's one vote.
Yeah.
All right? He doesn't all of a sudden magically show up and the Fed change its position. Well, by one vote, maybe, but that's it.
They always wanted to be collegial.
If anything, given the energy price shocks and where this is going to reverberate and the amount of time it's going to stay out there as a cost push problem, none of which has come out the other end in prices yet, although we're going to see it here in electrical prices this month. So in the next few days, I'm going to get my next bill, and it's going to be in those bills.
Well, I think we probably have. Right? Hey, a question. I didn't understand. I didn't listen enough of the testimony. He said he's going to revamp the way they look at prices. Is he going to look at? Is he going to be honest, or is he going to go the other way?
You know what? It sounded to me from that testimony that the deflator BS. That it's total black box that we can never figure out what the hell it is, right? How it's computed. It sounds like that may be going away.
Well, good. Unless they tell everybody what it is.
That'd be a good thing, don't you think?
Yeah, but Hal piped in.
I don't know what's replacing it.
Let me give you a quick. I don't know if you ever were on a. Well, CBOE was a reasonably big board. I mean, it wasn't like it was Exxon or anything. I was on that one. And let me give you a little lesson on corporate minutes. Yeah. The pressure to have, you can argue all you want, right? You could have a knockdown, you could even kick the staff out, if it was really got ugly. And the lady who took the notes, the corporate secretary, is a lady named Judy Deal. Happened to be a good friend of mine. She was head of membership when I was the chairman of the membership committee, so the two of us were business-wise about as tight as you could get, right? As a matter of fact, her husband wanted to get into getting horses, and she had never been near a horse. I said, meet me out and I'll take you by Audrey's horse. She's like, I didn't know they were that big. but anyway, her husband's a terrific guy, and I don't know where the hell they moved, but I think he ended up with alpacas or something, I don't know, but she was never been on a farm in her life, so I don't know, but she's a terrific lady, and they were they really liked each other, so it was, I'm sure it worked out, but I hope it worked out. Anyway, so they would have the minutes,
right?
And you'd be in this. It wasn't always me arguing; other people. And you get the minutes, and by the time they went to the, she would write down what actually happened. By the time it went to the legal department, then they would go to the outside firm to have them look at it. And you get this thing. You go, Yeah, that, was that the same meeting? And they didn't want anybody to vote. Once you were done arguing, everything was supposed to be unanimous.
No, I know.
So, I mean, you read the minutes and it looks like, I mean, if you all of a sudden voted the other way and it was in the minutes, my God, it was like you let off a stink bomb in a place. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
I mean, so the Fed minutes, who knows what really goes on in there? I mean,
I know. It's not a tape recording, right? You know, by the way, just to add into this, you realize that OpenAI has just pointed out that it missed on both new users and revenue. And their CFO has said, well, we're not so sure that this $1.5 trillion worth of commitments on data centers, we're actually going to be able to come up with the money.
That's interesting.
What have I been saying about this entire pull forward scam for the last couple of years?
Well, guys, UPS is
by the way, if you don't make any money doing it, you eventually run out of other people's, you know, willingness to fund your crap through various offerings, right?
Yeah. Well, does Hal want to pop in, or does he just want us to talk about it like we've been doing for all week?
Hey, what's up?
We just want us to talk about you? How smart you are?
I was just on Twitter watching people on Twitter are obsessed with bad calls by officials.
God.
No, really?
Watching some of those.
Well, you know, and speaking of which, while we still have Carl, have you been watching any of these baseball games with this challenge of the... I will say this, you can challenge like a ball and strike.
I kind of like humans doing it, but I like... What I'd like to see is humans doing the balls and strikes and then using that technology to determine who's the most accurate. Because I think an umpire has to be able to squeeze a pitcher sometimes or a catcher. I just do because of attitude. When I umpired and called balls and strikes, I would... You know, you have to do this in Little League and in high school. Sometimes a team's playing a pitcher, playing against a team who has a pitcher who can't hit the strike zone. And you don't want the game to be 5 hours long or 6 hours long because a team can't get a pitcher on the mound who can hit the strike zone. So what I do is I'd watch both pitchers warm up and I determine how wide my strike zone was going to be. I tried to keep the height because the coaches see the height of the strike zone from the dugouts. So I'd try to keep the strikes. I'd have it a little higher if one pitcher was weaker, and I'd give both pitchers the same strike zone. Now, in Little League, in high school, that's important to do. But I think it's important for umpires to have a little flexibility in their strike zone. And I don't care if they're calling 2 inches off the plate a strike, as long as it's being consistently called.
Well, you can't
throughout
call
the game.
2 inches outside a strike and then have 2 inches inside a strike because the guy's leaning over to get the outside one.
I think the inside of the plate and the outside of the plate are two different things.
Yeah.
If you have 2 inches on the outside of the plate, if you're calling that a strike, is Greg Maddux used to get those.
Well,
you have to call
there.
It consistently and fairly for both sides, both teams.
Well, here's the part that I will admit, being a baseball nut job since I was in Pee Wee League. You know, I never actually knew the definition. You know, I thought that, you know, if the ball was on the edge or something, if it was, you know, close right there, it was... I never actually knew that if you had a camera, that it was the absolute inner part of the ball versus the outer part of the plate. So if a part, one thousandth of the ball strikes the outer edge of the plate, that it was a strike.
Yeah.
I think in practicality, even though people might have known that was the rule, this has actually expanded the strike zone by damn near, let's say, half the diameter of the ball all the way around.
Yeah.
I mean, there was one in the Cubby, I mentioned this yesterday, the other night. To me, it was high and outside, and the guy challenged it. I'm going to say 1,000th of the ball hit the absolute upper outside and high little corner of the square.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, that's not a strike. And yet it was. You know, and I'm thinking, that ball's unhittable. I mean, if you can do that in all four of those corners, nobody can hit the damn thing.
Well, that's why Roger Clemens, he was on ESPN, and he was telling, he was justifying his salary to ESPN Sport, a reporter. And he said, I'm the only guy in Major League Baseball that can do this in the eighth inning of a playoff game. And he went about hitting all four corners of a strike zone that he put on his barn at, I think, 96 miles per
hour.
Okay,
but he, for him visually to know he hit the corner,
yeah,
the middle of the ball probably hit the corner. Not the inside hundredth of a centimeter.
All I care about is that it's consistent. That's all I care about.
I'm saying
in basketball, you know, referees.
I agree.
When there's a ball that goes out of bounds, and there's contact that is made, and that contact causes the player being fouled to lose the ball out of bounds, and it goes off the player being fouled, a lot of times referees would give it to the team that got fouled. But with replay, it messes that up.
Yeah.
Now those plays have to be called fouls. And that's what I don't like about replay. Use the replay to determine who's the most consistent and best official. I think they're messing up the game by turning it into some AI robot.
I do, too. I got a good one for you, Z. Yeah. Talk about bizarre worlds. Kyle's still with us?
Because the imperfection is what makes it beautiful.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah. I agree with you on that.
Let me give you a quick story. We were out of the blue when we were still at Mesro. We loved being at Mesro. And then when Jim Tyree died, the nicest man ever, they got out of the correspondent clearing firm, so we had to leave, went to RBC. RBC is okay, but we were real tight with Mesro. I mean, Jimmy had a great organization. Anyway, it was way better for us and clients. Now we're good, but we were better then. Well, so they call me up, and the guy Stan, who's the broker, correspondent, clearing guy, goes, "Hey, I got Jim's tickets tonight to go to the Bulls game. They're right on the court." I go, "Yeah, all right, I'll go." And I figured they were like maybe $400 a ticket. Turned out they were $750 a ticket. This is
wow.
15 years ago. So, of course, Stan comes down with a case of the flu, and he's dying, right? So now you can take a client, which we were, to a game when the ticket's that expensive. You can't just give it to them, or it's a big deal, right? So now it's a Saturday. They're calling around to their outside counsel in New York, what do we do with these tickets? Finally, they roust some guy out of a bar, their lead attorney, and he goes, "Just give the two guys a ticket." So I ended up bringing another guy from the firm. So we go, and we're sitting, literally, one of my feet was on one side of half court, and the other was on the other, right on the chair.
Oh, man.
So you can't get up and go get a beer. So you got a guy behind you who will go get you your beer if you want one, right? So, of course, you're not supposed to spill it on the floor. But so first half's kind of, you know, it's first half of NBA basketball, not a playoff game, and you know, I'm kind of
BS. They're just going through the motions.
Yeah, I'm kind of BSing with the ref a little bit. And all of a sudden, there's a couple of hard fouls starting the third quarter, and I go, "Wow, the price of poker's going up." He goes, "Yeah, it looks like I got to go to work and call a foul." He run down, blew his whistle. It was hilarious. He goes, "Yeah, it looks like I got to work this half." Which, it was so obvious that all of a sudden everybody was playing. But both teams was like the third game in four nights kind of a thing, you know, so.
Yeah, when you play an 82-game schedule, when I watched the Rockets play the Jazz back with Moses Malone and not Clyde Drexler, Robert Reed.
He's not still alive, is he, Moses? He's dead, isn't he?
Huh?
Moses isn't still alive, is he?
I think he passed away, yeah. But I was like in sixth grade, and I was the biggest Rockets fan outside of Texas. I mean, I wrote a book in sixth grade about the Rockets. For a class assignment. But we got to see the Rockets and the Jazz play. And what I noticed when I was a sixth grader is they kind of took off the first three quarters of the game. And then it got a little, it got exciting in the fourth quarter. That's when they started playing.
Well, even the first three quarters, you don't think they're playing hard, but nobody else can play with them. I mean, they are playing hard.
Nobody can, but it looked like it wasn't a game until the fourth quarter.
Yeah, you're not going to kill somebody until the fourth quarter.
But you're not going to set a crippling, pick.
Did you see the game the last night or night before? They had Ralph Sampson, Hakeem the Dream, and Elvin Hayes sitting right next to each other. Wow.
Oh, wow. That would have been awesome to see.
They all look pretty good. Ralph looks a little, but the rest of the other two guys look good.
Hakeem's my dude, man. Hakeem is the guy I copied. And I wasn't 7 foot tall. I was only, 6 foot one.
What was Ralph Sampson? 7 foot? Ralph Sampson was 7'4", wasn't he?
I think he was 7'2".
Okay, but he's
Hakeem was really only 6'11", but they always, it's better to say 7 foot, right? You got 2 7-footers.
Well, I mean, the biggest guy I ever saw, and I met Will Perdue downstairs in the bar, and he's, a lot taller than me. But God, one day I went to the Wrigley Field. This was, I'll admit, I was taller. I probably was touching 6'4", probably now I'm 6'2½" or something. But all of a sudden I see this guy walk by, and I look up. He's a full head taller, but it was Bill Cartwright. And he's bringing all these little kids to the game. The kids are like 7 or 8. They're up to like his thigh. It was the weirdest thing. But he all the kids were hanging. He's bringing them into the game and stuff. He's supposed to be a terrific guy.
Well, Thurl Bailey, I ran into Thurl Bailey about 8 or 9 times in Utah, and I remember and I met him at the economics conference, the governor's economic summit one year, before I met him on the basketball court. I walked up to him and I told him, hey, you guys cost me $20 for the big smile. And you know what he said to me? We did that to every American.
God. Hey, I got.
Then I run into him on the basketball court. I'm refereeing his son's game. His son was like 120 pounds, but 6'11". I mean, he was skinny. And I'm refereeing the game, and he's ripping me left and right, which I find great. I mean, Thurl Bailey's ripping me while watching his son play basketball. And after the game, I walked up and I said, hey, Thurl, hey, I just wanted to let you know that I enjoyed our conversation at the Utah Economic Summit. And he looked at me like, oh, you're that dude. But then I ran into him like 8 other times. But his son was like 6'11". I mean, his mom was a white lady. She was Mormon. Thurl's a converted Mormon. And they were both very tall. I think she was 6'8". She played for BYU, I believe.
Wow.
But, man, their son as a junior was like 6'11", and
date a 6'8" girl. Wow,
it was crazy seeing all three of them together. It was like watching people from Pandora walk through the courts. They were all very tall and very skinny. It was crazy.
We had a guy at Notre Dame when I was there. John Shumate was my contemporary, and he passed. All American. He was the guy, main guy on the team that beat Bill Walton and to break the streak. Well, there was a younger guy, and Shumate turned out to be a terrific guy, but in college he wasn't all the best. But then he ended up being a terrific guy. But the younger guy named Toby Knight, he was tall, he was so damn skinny, he had all the skills. He just, there was nothing to him, and I could like push him at the rack a little bit.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, his senior year, he comes back from summer. And it was like a miracle of male maturity. The guy must have been 30 pounds heavier.
Well, wow.
I didn't push him anymore. Neither did him. He ended up having a really solid senior year. He had like an 8-year pro career. I mean, he just developed late. I mean, but he's the nicest guy.
That's why these recruit rankings are so bad. You look at the two linebackers from Arizona State, both white guys. They got drafted in the NFL as safeties. One ended up dying in Afghanistan, and they're a few years apart, but I think one was Adam Archuleta, and then the one that died in Afghanistan, I'm having a hard time remembering his name, but I actually saw him play football, and he was just a crazy man on the football field. Those guys were like 5'7" and 170 pounds in high school, but if you watch their workout videos, they turned themselves into 5-star athletes. They were probably 0-star. They were like, Cam, the guy that played at Washington State and then went to Miami and then is a starting quarterback for Tennessee. He was a 0-star athlete. So you got these 0-star athletes that through sheer determination and will make it big time.
Some people just, you're a breaker. Some people you can tell. I mean, Audrey had a friend who, anyway, she's gone, but she had two kids, and the first kid was a star at everything.
Yeah.
But he was one of these kids that, when he was 12, 13 years old, he was already shaking.
He didn't have to ever work for it.
No, but he was just mature before. When he was 12, 13, he was shaving, one of those kind of guys.
Yeah.
But he never grew. He was as big when he was 15 as he was when he was 20. Yeah. His brother, on the other hand, kept growing. He ended up playing, being a star for Stanford, and actually did a tour in the minor leagues until, you know, he got a really good job from someplace. He didn't stop playing baseball. But some people just grow. The guy at Orlando Woolridge had a huge career with the Bulls and other places in the pros. When Notre Dame recruited him...
Well, that was the same thing with David Robinson.
Yeah.
He grew late.
Well, they recruited him as a guard. He was like 6'3". When he showed up, he was like 6'6". Like, what happened to you? He ended up being 6'9", or something like that. But
he ended up being a 7-footer, David Robinson.
Yeah. Well, some of those guys are, I mean, he might have been 6'11", but still, he's a huge man.
Yeah.
But, yeah, but there's no way. Plus, he was supposed to be a submariner. That wasn't going to work.
Oh, man, I don't know how he would have, how could he have existed on a submarine? It would have been. My buddy Rob was 6'4", and he had the hardest time sleeping in his rack.
Yeah,
he had the hardest time sleeping in a pit because I was 6'1", and I had to bend my knees to sleep. Rob had to bend his back and his knees to fit into that pit, and his knees were sticking out of it.
That's really something. Hey, quick question before we get a break. Is the Gerald R. Ford, the aircraft carrier, is evidently back in service. Because of that fire, they were in a Greek town. It wasn't Athens, right place, so I assume it's not that big of a town. It might have been a port. They were there for a month. What is the air group doing? What are the other 10,000 people doing? You're in this little Greek town for a month.
What probably would have happened is if there was enough beer to go around, they probably would have set up air bars on the pier. That happened to us when we went.
Everybody sleeps on the. But if the boat probably didn't have to go in dry dock if it was just a fire.
No, it didn't go in dry dock. No, but there probably wouldn't have been enough beer or alcohol to service all those sailors. So they probably set up bars on the pier. That's what happened when the Truxton pulled in. When I was on the Truxton, we pulled into Jeddah, I think. They set up a bar with those big wooden spools that hold that 2-inch wire. They put those spools in the sand just off the pier and then put folding chairs around them, and then they kind of roped it off. And the cool thing about it is people could bring their CDs and play their own music on a really nice sound system that you could hear within a mile of the bar. And it was just right off the pier. And you'd go in there and you would just pull a beer out of a bucket a big barrel of ice.
First of all, do they have a pier big enough for an aircraft carrier to tie up, or do they have to anchor the thing and fix it out there?
They probably had to anchor it. I don't know. I mean, the aircraft carrier is huge, and it goes pretty deep below the water. So, I suspect they probably had a floating. If they had to anchor it out, they probably had a.
Well, who do they send out to fix it? Is there like a.
Honestly.
Is there like a construction repair ship that shows up with a bunch of guys that know how to fix
all the... They have these floating repair ships. I think my next door neighbor Dave was on one of them, but I think his ship was more for repairing submarines. But I'm sure they have these repair ships, and they probably scheduled it where the carrier was parked next to this repair ship, and they'd have to get these guys off the ship to prevent them from going nuts. And I suspect, given that we were only 500 souls on the Truxton, and they set up a port side, a bar for us, a makeshift port. It was like MASH, the TV show MASH. But yeah, it was great. You pay a dollar to get a Heineken.
But they probably flew the air crew off, right? You wouldn't leave a sitting target with all your planes on it, would you?
Well, I think you're pretty safe in Greece.
But I mean, why would you leave the air crew sitting there for a month? I mean, there's airfields around there, right?
Well, I think maybe the planes probably they probably flew off. Yes, they probably landed somewhere else, right?
Yeah. All right, hey, we're gonna go to break.
They're not like permanently attached to the carrier. Our helicopter was a temporary deployment for the helicopter crew.
Okay.
So they when we were in port, they're somewhere probably 1,000 miles away from us. When we're in the United States, in home port, we never saw those guys again. They were deployed temporarily while we were deployed on a Westpac, Middle East and Australia and parts of Asia. They were part of us for 6 months, But as soon as we pulled into our home port, I think we left him in San Diego, honestly. Right, I don't remember. I mean,
we're going to go to break. We come back. Since we've been talking about you all week and examples of what you've been researching and also trying to get some idea if you've went on with that. Larissa and Russell were very interested. S&P futures down 55. NASDAQ futures down 382. Fed's meeting today, decision tomorrow. Labor numbers, even though Friday's the 1st, aren't until next week. But we do get the PCE number out of the Fed. And we get GDP first quarters. There's a lot of stuff this week, just not the labor numbers. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jacks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jacks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Low and no fake, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 53, NASDAQ Futures down 375. Here's a piece of news. We have to, after we're done with this, Hal can comment. I don't know what to make of this one at all. United Arab Emirates leaving OPEC effective May 1st. I have no idea what that means or what caused that or what the ramifications are. Maybe Hal can help. I'm sure they didn't call me, but it seems odd. I mean, I don't know. Over in Europe, DAX down 11.5%. FTSE up 3, call that flat. CAC around down 32.4%. Yesterday, the rest of Europe was up, and FTSE was flat, too. So FTSE's not doing much. The other guys are going up and down. Over in Asia, Nikkei down 619. That's a full percent. Hang Seng down 245, a full percent. Shanghai down 7.2%. Asia-Pacific markets trade mostly lower as investors assess latest U.S.-Iran signals. We're assessing. That's what we're doing. We're assessing. Bonds up 4 basis points. 4.37, that's a pretty good move. Bund up 4 basis points, 3.08. Oil, this is kind of the problem here, up 4.39. It's up back over $100, $100.76. RBOB, 3.55, up another 6 cents. This does not bode well for gas this summer. That puts it pushing 4.60, depending on your tax situation. Maybe more. Maybe more. Gold, down 105, 45.88. Nobody likes gold. Silver down 222, 7280, which is kind of surprising given what the dollar is doing. Foreign exchange, same place. 117 on the euro, 135 on the British pound. Crypto down 534, 76 to 224. Ricky, what do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Hey, good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:37 here in Chicago. We're looking at 53 degrees right now with a high of 64. Considerable cloudiness today, and tonight will be mainly cloudy with a shower around from late evening on and a low of 48 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 61 degrees right now with a high of 87. Partly sunny all day, and tonight will be cloudy with a low of 64 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, I'm seeing a lot of standstill traffic all over the place. Inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 23 minutes. We're looking at 41 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 34 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th, 26 minutes. And lastly, 36 minutes for Stevenson from 294. For the MLB, Sox beat Angels yesterday 8-7, and Cubs lose to Padres 9-7. Today we got Angels at White Sox at 6:40, Diamondbacks at Brewers at the same time, and Cubs at Padres at 8:40 p.m. For the NHL, the Penguins beat Flyers yesterday 3-2, and Golden Knights beat Mammoth 5-4. NBA first round, game 5, 76ers at Celtics today at 6 p.m., Hawks at Knicks at 7 p.m., and Trailblazers at Spurs at 8:30 p.m. If you're looking for a reason to raise a glass and give back, join Friends of Fisher House and Revolution Brewing for the Heroes for Heroes kickoff party, happening Friday, May 8th from 4 to 6 p.m. at their Ketzi Brewery. Swing through for food, raffles, good company, and a chance to learn about Fisher House and how they support our military. For the month of May, a portion of Revolution sales will be donated to Friends of Fisher House, providing a home away from home for veterans and military families. The event is free and open to anyone who will support. That's the Heroes for Heroes kickoff party on Friday, May 8th from 4 to 6 p.m. at 3340 North Ketzi. Save the date and raise a glass for our heroes. Back over to you, Chief.
So every time I drink a Revolution beer, I'm helping a military family?
For the month of May, yes, you are.
It's not a bad deal.
It's not a bad deal. Not at all.
So
drink Black Rifle coffee, too.
Is that made by Revolution Brewery?
It's made by a veteran. And a lot of the profits go to help veterans.
So our friend Wayne has proposed a trade for the Yankees. Evidently, you heard this, the rat story at Wrigley Field last week, where there was a rat sitting. Evidently, there's this wastebasket next to the Philly dugout. There's this huge rat sitting on the thing. Oh, so he's on camera, so he hops off.
Well, rats and roaches are your roommates in New York City.
Well, no, this is in Wrigley Field, Chicago.
So, I know, but yeah. In New York City, that's like, everybody has a rat and everybody has a roach for a roommate in New York City for the most part.
Oh, God. Well, the rat hops off, runs down the Philly dugout, runs over a couple of people's feet, and runs out into the outfield and then ducks under in his rat hole. Evidently, last night, the same sort of thing happened at Yankee Stadium. It was this huge feral cat.
Mm.
So Wayne is proposing that the Cubs trade for the cat to take care of the rat. And that's not a bad idea when you think about it. All right,
cats are great. They in the South, if you have a bunch of feral cats running around in the woods near your house, you're not going to have any mice, so you're not going to have any snakes.
Problem is they eat the birds too. You don't want them doing that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
All right, so explain to me why the Emirates is leaving OPEC, and then we can go into what research you're doing and how it's caught fire on the show for sure.
I think you know, cartels are hard to hold together. They're really difficult to hold together. So that's
but what
that's
do you get
one.
By what do you get by leaving?
Well, I know, but maybe they're gonna just pump oil independently of what their neighbors pump. Also, I think what's going on in the Gulf area is the Hormuz has long been a problem, and I think what you're going to see is a lot more bypassing of Hormuz. I think Saudi Arabia is probably going to invest in more pipeline. I could see other Gulf nations doing that. I think Iraq
Saudi
wants
has
to
the
get
one.
Away from going through the Hormuz Strait.
Saudi has the one. What do you suppose? I've not. Obviously, other than it's sand, what do you suppose the time frame to either expand or add? It's got to be 2 years.
Yeah, I mean,
minimum.
In the long run, I think we're going to have alternates to the Strait of Hormuz. You know, the funny thing is, I just asked ChatGPT what barrels per week has been for the last 12 months.
For where? Here
and
or anywhere?
If you look at world oil production, barrels per week for the last 12 months, it looks like it's been on the rise. I don't have April numbers, but you look at February, is 741. That's millions per week. And then March was 742. January is 739. So I think a lot of this, because you can't compare today to the 1970s. In the 1970s, about 36% of all crude oil was coming through the Strait of Hormuz. Today, it's probably about 20%. And then on top of that, if you look at the real price of gasoline per gallon, it's historically, I mean, it's a lot that we're paying today, you know, $4 a gallon. But when you adjust for inflation, it's not really that high. And then on top of that, a new car in 1976, got about 13 to 14 miles per gallon. Today it's double that. So we're not going back to the 1970s. Nobody's saying, hey, we got to cap gas prices, we got to ration gasoline. Nobody's saying that. And I honestly think, with it being an election year, honestly think this administration doesn't want this thing to linger. I mean, if you're worried about being impeached for a third time, I don't think you want this thing to last. I think what's going to happen is this blockade is the thing that's really working. The Iranian Guard has no revenue. They might have some reserves, but pretty soon they're going to have mass riots, and they're not going to be able to kill 90 million people to keep them under control. When people start to starve and they're hungry and they're desperate, humans turn into animals, and we know that from Venezuela, where people are killing animals in the wild and eating them raw. So I think this is going to be over, honestly. I think this is going to be over with by June.
Well, you're one.
And I think things are going to kind of return to normal. I'd like to see what April world crude oil production is for April. If it's 742, a lot of this price increase on a barrel of oil has to do with probably speculation. Because, I mean, in May of 2025, it was only 727. March of 2026 is 742. Assuming ChatGPT is right, but I think it probably is.
I wouldn't. There's some oil wells that have been shut off in the places that use the Strait of Hormuz, so it can't be higher.
I think what's happened is China's having to buy oil from the United States, and Europe is buying 80% of their LNG from America right now, United States. I think like 4 years ago, they were buying about 20%, but they're buying 80% roughly of their liquid nitrogen LNG from the United States. So I think what's happening is we're becoming a supplier to these countries,
which is great for people in the industry, but it's not great for us.
Yeah, but what it's going to do? You got these high prices, and that's going to trigger. You got these huge margins. It's going to trigger more maybe drilling in the United States.
I don't know. The
markets are really, no matter how much politicians mess up and overregulate and create barriers to entry with licensing and con laws and restrictions, markets are historically really resilient. And smugglers are the people who got commerce to the people. They're the ones able to navigate around all these restrictions these mercantilist governments of Europe put in place. And they're the ones that came to the United States and formed things like the mob. So the world has a long history of people knowing how to subvert the restrictions that government places on us, on the economies, to benefit their very small
people. I think when you get into an area like oil production, I mean, I certainly go with the theory, in a sense that higher prices will bring a little more production, but we've seen production rise and fall here based on availability. And I think there's been a little bit, and it's kind of worrisome to me, actually, seeing a little bit in the last few months of a drop down. And by the way, Kevin sent something in that's interesting.
Tom, also what's going on, electric vehicle sales are soaring in the United States, used and new. And in Europe,
electric vehicle sales
are increasing like, 30 to 40%.
Okay, but that which means you got to do something with the grid.
Exactly.
What I'm saying, though, is that the oil industry...
People adjust. People will figure it out.
I look at the daily production here, and that's what I look at. Now, Kevin was asking, when you look at the February numbers versus March... you're talking about three more days in March when you look at the world production numbers.
Yeah.
No, I don't know how you get the production numbers.
Well, January 739, according to this.
I don't know how you get the numbers out of Russia or those kinds of places. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Plus, are we talking production or are we talking about shipments? I mean, what I'm saying is, I mentioned it earlier in the show.
People want to supply when crude oil prices are high. That rhymes.
But there's a difference between...
Maybe that's why Oman's breaking away. They don't want to be restrained by...
Get your country right. Emirates. OPEC. Emirates.
Yeah. Or Emirates, right.
I couldn't find either one of them. Well, but they don't get to go to the big meetings in Vienna where they get to eat shrimp and drink booze and have hookers like they do.
Yeah, but they can do that at home in private homes, in their private complexes.
All right. Well, as long as they're not losing out on the shrimp.
They're wealthy enough where they can do that anywhere in the United States. Maybe they're going to Vegas.
Well, they could go see Epstein, except he's dead.
Maybe they're going to go hang out in the United States with, the World Cup. The people that go to the UN in New York are there for to party, right? They're not really there to solve world problems.
Well, some maybe are, but...
I've heard
World Cup tickets are extraordinarily expensive.
Oh, yeah, especially in places like New York, New Jersey. Yeah,
one of my guys last night was telling me they're like $6,000 a ticket in New York or something.
Yeah. And I don't think that's American demand. That's international demand. Which
leads me into the Hal Snar theory that we've been talking about to everybody else in the last week. This idea that you've essentially, without knowing it, you've taken Milton Friedman's observations on inflation and taken them up a notch. And his was that they're never...
Well, this is Cantillon. This is 300 or 400 years old.
Well,
this is nothing new.
Well, you're the one who dug it up. For us, anyway. I mean, I didn't say you're 300 years old, but you dug it up for us. So, I mean, I'm not telling people like Milton Friedman said it yesterday. I'm just digging it up for them. But he said, inflation is the cruelest tax. It's always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, and you can't let it get started.
But it's not a tax for people who touch the money first, right?
Okay.
It's actually a subsidy.
Well, that leads right into the Hal Snar argument or revelation and research you've been doing regarding who gets to borrow the money. Yeah. And it went off in my feeble brain this week. Hey, we lend money to people all the time. All they got to do is send us half the price of a stock. We'll lend them the other half. Yet to get that same money out of a bank to remodel a house is like pulling somebody's canine. I mean, so my question is, you've been continuing down this path and doing more and more research. What have you done recently to either expand on it, or have you paused a little bit?
Well, it's going to be my next research project. Right now, I'm working on a research project that looks at state minimum wage rates and uses employment. My next project is going to be how the banking rules that were changed in March of 2020 affecting employment growth within the financial non-depository firms. Non-depository banking firms, non-depository financial firms.
What does that mean? What's a non-depository firm?
Yeah,
for everybody.
And then the firms that.
What is a non-depository firm?
Well, I mean, all I know is the loans are disaggregated by sector.
Right.
And what I've seen is traditional loans to businesses.
Okay.
Consumers. Other than credit cards, you know, not including credit cards, but just, you know, loans. But to consumers and businesses, they're mostly flat in the last couple of years. But these loans to what the Federal Reserve calls non-depository financial institutions are up 40% in about a year and 2 months. So they're getting the money first. This is the Cantillon effect.
Right.
Right. Whoever gets that money first is actually receiving a subsidy. Not a tax.
Well, it's got to be margin loans. It's got to be loans to buy baseball teams. You know,
they're receiving a government subsidy. By the time that money makes it down to everybody else, we're paying the tax of inflation.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's
just called the Cantillon effect.
And I was doing
and
some.
And the quantity theory of money cannot account for it because the quantity theory of money relies on overly aggregated metrics, right? Aggregated to the nation level, right? Velocity, the stock of money, GDP.
Well, that's what all Friedman's research was essentially like that. You pour money into the system. Yeah. 6 months later, it blows out. He never really went and found out who it blew out to. He just.
Yeah.
But then again, in those days, I don't know that you had the same sort of stuff like you have here. I mean, you and I could not get a remodeling home on a house for $100,000 if we want to buy the Cubs for $8 billion. They're dying to give us the money. I mean, I don't know if that happened.
The system is currently set up to incentivize those kind of loans.
No, but I'm not saying that was so obvious in the 70s where Friedman would have noticed it, is my point.
I think the change in the banking rules has put this Cantillon effect that is hidden by the quantity of theory. It's hidden by the quantity of theory.
It has to do a lot with the combinations of the banks.
Yeah.
Right.
But it was exposed dramatically by these changes in the banking system that are frankly outrageous. People should be outraged. People should be in the street protesting these banking rules that incentivize one kind of loan. A loan to be used to buy an asset, a financial asset of some sort. People should be in the street.
Right, when you say financial asset, you're talking about stocks.
Yeah, just financial assets in general, right? Yeah.
That's what I've been talking about for 2 days.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, yesterday NVIDIA's down today, but yesterday, if NVIDIA's up $10, that's $250 billion in value. That's $125 billion that people can borrow tomorrow. Down to stock, we go back down. Borrow tomorrow and buy more stock. Where for a bunch of schmoes like you and me, Hal, and the rest of the people listening to the show, for us to get $125 billion worth of loans out of banks for stuff we want to do, I can't imagine what it would take to do that. Could you?
I know,
It's not even close. Not to mention, they'd want what percentage for us, I suppose we could all max out our credit cards at 25%.
Yeah.
We could all do that, but I'm not so sure that gets us to the same place as a margin loan at 6 or 7 or 5, whatever the hell they're charging. Anyway, so I guess I'm saying you don't know how right you are. Larissa and our other economists.
Well, we were nibbling at this, Tom. We were nibbling at this for like 5 years.
Yeah, yeah.
We're both saying, we were both observing the consequences of this kind of lending, right? We were both nibbling at it. But then when I taught that macro class last fall, and I hadn't taught macro probably since 2017. When I taught that macro class, or money and banking. So when I taught that macro class last fall, some student asked me something that triggered me to dig into it, because the book was still teaching the pre-financial crisis nonsense. The textbook was still teaching that stuff. And the students were asking me about this, and I dug into it, and that's when I discovered these really perverse banking rules. No reserve requirement, capital requirements, and liquidity requirements. All intended to do what? Maybe not intended, but they were. But what is the result of it? Is there's only one kind of loan that is incentivized. And corporate debt can be held by banks, high-quality corporate debt, can be held by banks now, and that creates an artificial demand that wouldn't have existed otherwise, which does what? When you increase the demand of a corporate bond, you raise the price and you lower the rate, right? You lower the yield. So you have all these rules that are in, that whether intended or not, and I'm kind of I'm leaning toward intended, that skew the lending, especially from these massive corporate banks. It skews it where only a small percentage of the population is able to tap this credit and buy these assets before the prices have had a chance to rise.
I'm with you. I mean, but it used to be, I'll just mention what you're talking about kind of is, I won't say it always happened, but there's been pockets when it happened. How familiar are you, because unless you dug into it, because I had one of our original clients was all involved in this stuff, in the Resolution Trust. I don't know if you ever had a chance to dig into that at all.
Oh, I haven't, huh?
If you get yourself an hour someday with nothing to do, which I know you don't have an hour with nothing to do, dig in a little bit to the history of the Resolution Trust. And actually, there's some stuff in there about how crooked it was by a guy named Sherman Skolnick, of all people. He was a guy...
Sherman Skolding?
Skolnick.
Skolnick.
Yeah, he was an attorney, a Jewish guy. How can I put this? Not easy on the eyes. He was in a wheelchair. He must have been paralyzed from birth or something. I don't know. But his parents never really did much for him, so he had teeth that, you know, looked horrible. But he'd be on TV. The guy was brilliant. But he was Mayor Daley's absolute pain in the ass, the original Mayor Daley. Because the guy would write papers and do opinion pieces. And he was brilliant. He was always right. And whenever Daley tried to, you know, Daley won, was a pretty damn good mayor. But, you know, once in a while, he'd lob one out there. I can't imagine what this guy would do with today's politicians.
Yeah.
Well, he ended up, after that, doing a lot of work on the Resolution Trust.
But now, I just ChatGPT'd it.
But anyway, the Resolution Trust, if you were part of the in crowd and you had whatever percentage of money to go after these assets, these savings and loans in the 2000s had blown up with all that stuff, the big crisis, the government would lend you 80 cents on a dollar. They you could get the loan directly from them at a really good interest rate. But if you were really in with the in crowd, they lent you the first 20, so then they'd lend you the other 80. And
wow.
And if you had interest groups, like when I talk about these people, man, how crooked some of these dudes are. Well, my buddy CW, all these people, he had all these properties out in Arizona, you know, in the Keating area. Keating was like the biggest developer, and he was like second or third. But he didn't, you know, he got out of his stuff earlier. He kind of sniffed the odor coming out of the financial markets. But he was saying that there was the Phoenician was part of these. All these savings loans went under, right? Actually, this is Volcker time. It's not 2000. All these savings and loans went under. So they were essentially auctioning off the assets.
Yeah.
And they were trying to put together packages of assets for people to get like 5 properties or 10 properties. And, you know, and the government was giving you all the dough. But you were buying stuff at 15, 20 cents on the buck. So the Phoenician, the guy paid way too much for it. But if you got it at the price it went at auction, only an orangutan could not make money at that price, right?
Yeah.
Plus, if they're loaning you the dough. Well, these guys put together a list of these properties and made a bid at the Resolution Trust. And all of a sudden, some buddies from Bush in Washington said, no, we don't want guys buying like only 4 or 5 properties. We want the minimum to be 10.
Mm.
And sure enough, some bid came out of Washington. Guys connected to Bush won. And they ended up getting the stuff like 40% cheaper than the bid was in Arizona.
Yeah.
So this has always been, it's always been people that could access capital less than other people because everybody was broke. So the idea of being
able to, what this whole thing is Resolution Trust Corporation.
Yeah.
I think what it is kind of a vacuum cleaner. Austrians argue that easy money and low interest rates by the central bank creates malinvestments, investments that wouldn't have made otherwise. And
these were investments you would have made, but nobody had any money except the people who got the money from the government.
Well, I mean, what I mean by wouldn't have been made otherwise,
yeah,
with the interest rates being set really, really low, lower than market rates, lower than the natural interest rate, by having interest rates set really, really low and credit being easy, then what happens is you get these malinvestments, things that wouldn't have materialized had the central bank not expanded the credit so much and pushed interest rates so low.
The example would be
when the bubble burst, then we see where the malinvestments are, and so this is a way. It looks like a scheme where very rich and well connected elites get to buy the stuff at fractions,
without a doubt. And yeah, you see it all over the place. One of my clients and good friends and listeners.
I was in the Navy during this time.
Well, the if you look at this presidential towers here,
yeah,
I think there's 4 huge apartment buildings, huge, and they're built 30, 40 years ago. Way too big. I mean, the West Loop, there's no way that many people want to live there.
Yeah, that's a malinvestment.
Yeah, so
that's what Austrians call a malinvestment.
So Dr. J's dad was one of the original investors. So it ends up now the people. This is why I always talk about stadiums. Same thing. The people who had the cable contract, the people, the front doorman contract, they all made a bunch of dough. All the investors lost all their money. I mean, I think one of my buddies told me they had a rent, which is normal turnover. They had a rent something like the idea of 15 apartments a day just to stay even or something.
Wow,
it was that big. And so all of a sudden,
the financial crisis is littered with these kind of examples, right?
All of a sudden,
San Diego and Miami, they had these apartment complexes or condominium complexes that people weren't living in.
Well, you don't.
They're just empty.
But I mean, when they went out for auction, when the thing blew up, I think Pritzker's group ended up buying it for like, you know, 30 cents on the buck.
Well, wow.
At that number, you know, it's fine. I mean, I guess the same.
Maybe that's the actual valuation, right?
Well, no. People would have paid more.
That's the valuation that it would have been in a free market.
Juiced
market.
I have a feeling that the valuation of free market might have been slightly higher than that.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
I mean, it's. Yeah. I had a after this one. I'm like too many stories today.
You're right. If he got it for 40 cents on the dollar, the market might have been 50 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
And he makes money when it recovers.
Right.
He makes 10 cents on the dollar. Right.
Yeah, and it's so. You saw that in 2008 with all the banks that were going under, right? And people were picking up every weekend. You saw, but you know, somebody picked up a bank in the so
on the cheap, yeah.
Well, they were bizarre with the bad loans. FDIC would absorb, so the next bank would. You know, you'd hear this story about how you know, Hal Bank picked up Chiefs Bank for you know, $50 million. And you look at it and you go, wait a minute. Chiefs Bank's got 3 locations, 5 drive-throughs. How many, you know, how many, the cost of replacing that.
And by the FDIC offloaded the bad.
Yeah, they offloaded the bad loans. So there was a.
I'm in the wrong business, Tom.
Actually, the lady's running again, Melissa Bean. She was the keynote speaker at this Mesereau shindig out in Washington, and they asked me to go out there and talk about options and protecting portfolios and stuff. I was not the keynote speaker. I was a speaker. She was the keynote speaker. And all this stuff's happening, right? And I said to her, you know, I know your politics a little bit because I saw her. She was coming. I'm thinking you would like more banks rather than less. And she goes, absolutely. And I said, well, okay. Now, last weekend, there just happened to be like three banks taken over. And I said, okay, in Congress, do a few people from each side of the aisle get in a committee and kind of review these bids? And she goes, what are you talking about? And I said, well, these three banks went under. It looked to me like they got them pretty cheap. Does anybody review these on just an ongoing basis, you know, in your whatever duties Congress has, to sit there and go, wait a minute, somebody must have paid somebody off, somebody was sitting on somebody's lap, well, you could say that in those days, and, you know, what's going on? She looked at me like I had four heads. She goes, why would you do something like that? I said, well, let me turn the question around. I said, I don't want to ask you two questions, but I'm going to. How do I get in that room? And she goes, well, you can't. I go, okay. I mean, what kind of a conversation is that? We know it's a great price, but by the way, we're not letting anybody in but the right people.
I'm going to drop a bomb with you and the listeners. I think the powers that be, whoever they happen to be, hey, that rhymes,
yeah,
have designed a banking system and a Federal Reserve system where, with interest on reserves and the changes in the banking rules, they've created a system where leverage, heavy leverage, is going to generate massive positive returns because they keep most of the new money bottled up in the banking system, and whatever money leaks out of the banking system is fueling this incredible inflation in financial asset prices, whether it's real estate, stocks, or what have you. So they're creating a way that these very few people can make these incredible returns on heavily leveraged assets, and that they're hoping that the system never pops. Well, the system would have popped in the absence of interest on reserves.
All right, last question because we're over. What Carl says, it's got to pop. I say
it's got to pop, but man, with all these new institutions and policies put in place, they can extend it for a long time.
That's kind of where I'm coming to. And my question is, yeah, is it already long enough? We know it's not infinite, but I don't think it's tomorrow either.
Yeah.
Which leaves a speculation, right?
Yeah, anyway, I think they've engineered a system where they think the leverage can continue generating 100% return.
I think you are absolutely correct. They think they can.
Yeah.
Carl thinks they can't. I think Carl's probably right in the long run, but the long run might be.
They can't, but when's that bubble pop in the long run? When's the long run end?
The day you and I get long.
Yeah.
That's the day. The day you and I borrow a bunch of dough, right?
Yeah, when they dupe me into this scheme.
When all of a sudden they let you in on it, that's it.
Let us in.
Yeah.
Hey, come on in.
S&P futures,
let us in on the deal.
S&P futures have come back. They're only down 40. NASDAQ futures down 301. Hal, good as usual. Talk at you later next Tuesday, if not before. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.